Hello, welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today, we're gonna talk about weeds. And Ralph Whitesides is USU's extension weed specialist and a professor in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate here at Utah State University. And we'd love to have you join our conversation because the information you're going to get today is going to save you a lot of heartache later in the summer. And if you do have weeds that grow, you can blame Ralph, right?
Yeah. We don't want to take credit for all the weeds.
No, he's going to help you a lot with your garden. So give us a call. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can be the first person to ever tweet us your question at hashtag Zesty Garden. Ralph, thanks for coming in.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Brian.
Well, I was already, I've been telling my son starting in February, see, the weeds are almost here, and I took him out in the garden last Saturday to help with some pruning. He's like, no, it's too early to go out in the garden. Now, he's going to appreciate everything that he gets to eat from the garden, but the thing he hates the most is weeding. So I thought maybe what I could do is learn a little bit about how I can help him from having to weed quite so much. Now, part of my problem is that I flood irrigate, so I'm going to get weeds coming in all the time. And weeds will show up that I have never seen before. All of a sudden, boom, they're in the garden. So I figure they're probably coming in off of the water. But what can I do right now to keep that weed problem down? And it could be anywhere from your grass, it could be out in the garden, it could be anywhere. What's the number one technique?
That's a good question, Brian, and one of the big issues is weed prevention. As a matter of fact, if you think about weed prevention in those terms, I like to think of it as sort of a higher order of weed control. Most of the time we go to the garden, we see the weeds are there, and we pull them out. And that's sort of a reactive response. The weed prevention is proactive. And you've hit on one of the key issues. Irrigation water that comes from a river and then is diverted through a canal that is open and has a lot of vegetation growing on the side of the canal and then is diverted into the irrigation system, even through sprinkler irrigation systems, if part of the route is open water. The seeds move through there, and then when you sprinkle irrigate, you end up giving yourself a really nice pattern of weed seeds spread across the entire area. So one option is to say to yourself, what can I do? Is it possible for me to put a screen in the system? Is there some way that I can actually sort of filter my water before it arrives and do a better job? The biggest problem with the screen is unless it has some sort of regular mechanical cleaning operation is you end up plugging the system. So that means you teach your son the value of cleaning off the weed seed screen on a regular basis so that he goes out there and appreciates the fact that work now will eliminate all that hand weeding later on in the year.
But how small does that screen have to be as far as the holes in the screen? Because some seeds are pretty tiny.
Most of the seeds for weeds are really tiny. So the screen is effective in blocking most of the plant material. When that first flush of material comes down the canal, there's a lot of debris that was left over from last year. It picks up along the edges, and you get a lot of dry material. So you're basically going to remove all of that. The little tiny seeds, if you put in a screen that's effective enough to control the little tiny seeds, you'll also stop the water flow, so which is not acceptable. So at this point, simply saying to yourself, well, maybe I could do some preventive work by going up my ditch and looking at the ditch banks before the water is diverted. What can I do to take my little weed whacker or the string trimmer and cut some of those weeds off so that the weed seeds are not there and that they're up on the bank out above the water level? Always makes good sense to look at the place where the weed seeds might be coming from before they arrive to you.
Now, I'm just guessing that most don't have a garden as large as I do and probably don't have access to irrigation water as much, or they're watering with drip irrigation, which is a great way to go, or with culinary water. So what can a person do they're not getting the influx of new seeds all the time, so it's either being blown there or coming in off of some material that they might bring in from outside?
Yeah, there are a variety of things you can do besides irrigation water. And if you're using culinary water, you never have a problem with weed seeds coming in the culinary water. However, as soon as your friend down the street says to you, oh, I have some horses, I have some cows, and I've been stockpiling my manure here, and you're sure welcome to come put some of that in my garden, then you have to ask yourself the question, the preventive activity that I can undertake is to maybe look at the hay that these horses and cattle have been eating, determine if it's full of weed seeds, and ask whether or not the manure that I'm about to bring into the garden has ever been composted. If it's been composted and you're bringing compost in, and the compost has been heated to about 140 degrees or more for a specific period of time, usually a number of hours, 7 to 8 hours, then the chances that you're bringing in new weed seeds are greatly reduced. However, almost all of us at one time or another have gone out, gotten some manure, got some bedding from someplace. We increased our organic matter in the garden, no question about it, and it was a huge improvement. And at the same time, we introduced a whole bunch of species that we never saw in the garden before. So knowing where the compost comes from, knowing where maybe the mulch comes from, either bark mulch or tree chips or things like that, and being aware of grass clippings is another option. A little later on in the year, inevitably somebody's lawnmower breaks down, and then you borrow your neighbor's lawnmower. Maybe you never thought about, boy, it's really great to borrow my neighbor's lawnmower, but does my neighbor have weeds that I don't have? And when I run that lawnmower over my yard, will I be introducing those weeds? So there are a variety of things you can do that are preventive that have to do with managing the equipment, making sure things are clean. And then when you take your grass clippings to the green waste facility, and you kick all of your grass clippings out, and you walk through those grass clippings, you have to ask yourself the question, did everyone else sanitize their grass clippings from weeds before they got here? Or am I walking through all of their seeds, and will I bring them all back home with me?
So let's take a look at the composting part of the equation. If you're like me, and you have a pile where you throw compost, but it's not an active heating pile, it just kind of slowly breaks down, I'm assuming that the seeds that are in there are not necessarily breaking down because they're not. It's not being heated up.
Absolutely correct. I've worked with people, and one of my friends pointed out that he has a compost pile and that he actively pulls all of his weeds all year long, puts them in the compost pile, and his observation was, I have the same weeds, I just have more of them each year. And so we started talking about managing the compost pile, getting the compost pile to heat, buying a thermometer that has a long stem on it so that you can actually monitor the temperature. And if you do that and the compost pile gets to 140 degrees, and that seems to be the magic number, if it gets to 140 degrees, then the weed seeds that are in there, the ones that you've had trouble with over and over and over again, will be killed. And then when you put the compost back in the garden, you get the nutrient benefit that you were hoping for, you get the organic matter increase that you were hoping for, but you don't get any viable weed seeds.
And when we say heating it up, we're not talking about sticking it in the oven to heat it up. We're talking about a biological means, that it a process that takes place when you've got just the right amount of green versus the right amount of brown in that same pile. What is the magic formula to make sure you get that heat up?
I'm not a compost expert, but most of us, when we've dumped our grass clippings in a pile, by the time we're through mowing the rest of our lawn, if you reach into the pile, you can see that the clippings have started to heat. And that heating process is the natural decomposition that's going on. And most of the time it takes place under conditions where you have appropriate moisture and a carbon to nitrogen ratio that's about right. So for the average homeowner, a really dry pile of material, it does not compost. So it needs to be moist, and it needs to be in a place where it can be turned, because the middle of the pile will achieve 140 degrees when the exterior of the pile is not yet warm. So you need to be able to invert it so that you can kill everything. Otherwise, all you've done is kill some of the seeds in the middle of the pile. Commercial composters, people who run compost piles, monitor the temperature all the time. They add water, they add organic matter as and they add nitrogen to the operation in order to get an appropriate balance. And so the people, for example, who make commercially bagged compost that they sell, they've gone through the composting process and they meet that minimum requirement so they can market it as a fertilizer as well as weed free.
So with that compost pile, how long, I mean, I know we're going into compost here, but I'm also trying to decide how much of it really should I use back in my garden, because I love to have that extra organic matter. How long is it going to take to break down, or does that depend on how much we're on top of it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It depends on what you put in the pile. So if all it is grass clippings, that's the breakdown is relatively rapid because they're high in moisture to begin with. But if you start mixing your corn stalks in there, then all of a sudden you've added a lot of organic matter that's really difficult to break down. And so unless you're chipping the corn stalks and making it into smaller and smaller pieces, then probably one season to the next is the best you can expect.
Do you know, and anyone that lives in an agricultural area has heard of a farmer whose hay has just spontaneously combusted, and that's probably because there was just too much moisture in it.
Right. Most of the time when we put up baled hay, it is in the neighborhood of 16 or 17% moisture. If it's more wet than that, then it can heat and then it spontaneously combusts. So when we're putting our grass clippings in a pile, we're already putting something in that's probably 70% moisture or more when we cut it. And so it heats up very quickly.
And don't put it right next to your barn.
Yeah, no. Or
just
in your barn.
Case.
Yeah, or in your barn. So that's a good observation. Another thing that you mentioned is if you want to be effective in your weed prevention, you also need to think about where you put your irrigation water. And if you can drip irrigate or trickle irrigate or irrigate only the area that you where you have desirable plants growing, you are in effect practicing weed prevention. If you irrigate the entire garden, then what you're doing is you're irrigating all of the weed seeds that are there, and in essence, you're causing a new problem.
I know whenever I've been irrigating and it breaks out of the row and floods somewhere, I just, ugh, because I know what's going to happen within the next week. I'm going to have seeds coming up all over the place.
Likewise, placing fertilizer is the same thing. In many cases, when you buy commercial fertilizer, a lot of us spread that fertilizer over the garden completely, wall-to-wall, fence-to-fence. And what we're doing is we're fertilizing all of the weeds that might be growing in areas where there are no crops. So placing the fertilizer carefully in the row or by the row so that the crops use it but the weeds don't is another technique for weed prevention. Two really important things that we don't think too much about. There is a great reference, too, for those people who are looking to more isolate their water a little more. Jeff Banks, our county agent in Juab County for Utah State University, has published a document about how to make a little garden watering system out of PVC pipe. Very cheap, has valves, and it just talks about drilling holes and tells you how to drill the holes. It's available online. You can Google the PVC pipe irrigation system or Jeff Banks, and it comes right up. It's really a slick way to reduce the amount of water that you use, so it's water conservation, but it's weed prevention as well.
Can it be found through the gardens.usu.edu website?
It can.
Website?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And just look for PVC pipe irrigation system.
Great. And again, I said this last week, but I highly recommend that website. There's everything you need to know about gardening. Is it gardens with an S or is it garden?
I don't know. We'll have to look it up and see.
I just have a link to it, so I haven't done this for a while. So gardens.usu.edu. I'm going online right now, and I think it's garden. Yep, it's garden.usu.edu to make sure that you get to the right address. So what are some other weed prevention things? You can put a weed barrier down, and I've been thinking of doing that in this native section where I'm just tired of I don't know if they're native weeds. Some of them are, I'm sure, keep coming up inside of that. So why don't you talk about weed barrier?
Well, weed barrier is another option that's really been successful. A lot of the weed barriers that we see as mulches are primarily designed to be deep enough so that no sunlight gets to the soil, and in the process of doing that, the weed seeds don't germinate. But you can also buy this barrier fabric, weed cloth or weed barrier, and that allows water to penetrate, but does not allow the weed seeds that germinate underneath it to penetrate the fabric. They work very, very effectively, and if they are covered with some kind of a mulch, like bark or rock or something along those lines, they don't photodecompose. And so some of those have been in place for in excess of 20 years, been very, very successful, and they stop most of the, certainly most of the annual weeds. If you spread bark on top of those every year, and as the bark decomposes, you actually get a little tiny layer of semi-soil on the top where the weed seeds that blow in can germinate, but they're easy to pull out because they're in the bark mulch, and it's a fairly easy maintenance thing. You mentioned earlier another weed prevention technique, and that is you have to be kind of evaluate what your relationship is with your neighbors. But if your neighbors have weed seeds that spread by wind, and you can do anything at all to keep them from going to seed, then the chances of them blowing into your yard are greatly reduced. So taking a look at what the dandelions are doing in the neighbor's yard, or the salsify, or some of the other really pretty plants.
Are you suggesting going out in the middle of the night and spraying their dandelions?
I'm not spraying their dandelions, but maybe if they are reluctant to mow them and you could just slip across the fence and mow the weeds in the neighbor's yard to keep them from going to seed with their approval, that's probably a good prevention technique.
Yeah. What types of seeds are usually carried on the wind?
Almost all members of the sunflower family are moved by the wind, and so almost all of the bad thistles are moved by wind. So bull thistle and musk thistle and scotch thistle, Canada thistle, and all of the prickly lettuce plants, things like horseweed and others that grow throughout the state. And then when they mature, they produce a really beautiful flower. And then when that flower matures, they end up with a little seed that has a parachute attached to it. And that parachute makes it possible for that seed to be moved, sometimes great distances, depending on how much wind is blowing in that general area.
Would you also see, I guess, if the wind's kicking up off the West Desert, what types of seeds would be coming in off the desert? Because I see that quite often during the summer.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's another category of weeds that are moved by wind, and those are the traditional tumbleweeds. So kochia and Russian thistle are two that we see growing on the West Desert, who, if they break away from the ground and start to roll, can end up trapped along fence lines. We see that all the time. And you can tell the path that these plants follow, because the following year there are things that we refer to as kochia trails or Russian thistle trails, whereas they rolled, most of the time these plants are not a perfect sphere. They're more egg-shaped or they're elliptical. And so they kind of roll and bounce and roll and bounce and roll and bounce. And when they do that, each time they bounce, they drop seeds. So the trail is pretty obvious. It's obvious where it blew from and how it got into your area. In the residential areas, most of the time, these are not a problem unless you happen to have a vacant lot or a roadside somewhere along the way that is not carefully monitored. And then these plants can mature, break away, and blow across the road and end up in your yard. Then you have a new set of problems. And again, wind blown, but this time not with a little parachute.
Now, another weed prevention technique does require some weeding right now, but if you're pulling weeds now, then it doesn't allow them to reseed, because some of them actually have several generations in one year, don't they?
Yeah, that brings us to a second phase of that. Puncture vine, which most of us really detest, is one of those that germinates all year long. And so it can germinate in the spring and in the summer and in the fall. It's also spread in terms of weed prevention by sticking into the tires. So it sticks into the tires of the car or the tires of the bicycle, or the bottoms of your shoes. And simply thinking weed prevention, when you sit down and you look at the bottom of your shoe or your boot, because you've been overlooking at the neighbor's garden and you're impressed at the job they're doing, and you realize you have puncture vine stuck seeds, the goat head, traditional goat head, stuck in the bottom of your shoe, and you pull those out, the next question is, what do you do with those? And you just simply do not throw those back in your garden, or now you'll have a problem. So you carefully put those in the trash so they go to the landfill where they might get composted, but at least not ending up in your yard. So thinking about what can come in and how it can come in and how you might be responsible is all part of this big weed prevention package.
So how do you know at what point that you should throw away a weed versus when you can throw it in your compost or just throw it down on the ground? I know for what I'm doing, since I have red root pigweed all over in the garden. It's just there every year. I know as long as I've got it picked before the seed head starts forming, I should be okay, but maybe I should be throwing it out if it's already blossomed. How many seeds or weeds are able to continue once they flower, even though you've pulled them out until...
Yeah. It's another great observation. Our experience with that has been that a mature plant that has just started to flower, if you pull it up and leave it intact, often has enough moisture in the stem that it will at least finish a few seeds. And our best example of that is Dyer's Woad, the plant that will soon be in flower.
And we've talked about that many times on this program. Yeah.
And once Dyer's Woad plants begin to flower, as soon as they begin to flower and some of the flowers begin to be mature, if you pull them up and don't cut them up in pieces and let them dry out or lay them out someplace where they can dry, some of the seeds will be produced and they'll be viable. So the probably the big safety mechanism is it doesn't do very much good to pull a dandelion, for example, when it's already a big puffball. If you put that puffball in the compost pit, then for sure that puffball has to get to 140 degrees before it will die. On the other hand, if you dig the dandelion when it's vegetative or just when it's in the yellow flower, the chances are pretty good that it won't produce any seed, and you can maybe stop that one by preventing it from going to seed.
I'm thinking of plants when I pull them up in the middle of the day and they just completely wilt. It's more likely those aren't going to be able to survive, and red root tends to be one of those.
Right.
I mean, it can be crispy by the end of the day. Purslane, however, is one of those that
right.
it's holding on to its moisture and probably would continue to try and produce.
That's so true. Common purslane looks like a succulent, and because it looks like a succulent, even though it's been plucked from the ground, it has enough moisture in the leaf and in the stem that it can go ahead and continue making viable seed later on through the day.
I know we're supposed to be able to eat it. You could put it in a salad. I haven't tried it yet. So
we've tried it. We've had a salad with purslane in it. It's if you have a lot of other things in there with it and good salad dressing, it's okay. But probably in that order.
Or if you're really hurting for a salad, I guess you could try it.
Straight purslane salad probably is not my favorite.
Well.
No, not my favorite.
Have you done a dandelion salad before?
I've tried dandelion. I find dandelion to be a little on the bitter side.
Okay.
And
so maybe, again, young dandelion leaves thrown in with a regular salad, because you wouldn't want to have a whole salad of bitter greens.
Right. And of course you want to be careful that it's not an area that you just sprayed.
Yeah.
Before you did that and put it in the salad. So I guess you could always say this is not really a weed, it's a crop. I'm growing this as one of my vegetable crops.
I tend to, when it comes to my lawn, I don't know, it's more walking on it than anything else. And I'll try to pull them up. And dandelions are one of those that have those long tap roots. And if you break them off, you want to explain what happens?
Yeah. My colleagues at the University of Idaho did a research study on digging dandelions, because almost all of us have spent time with a dandelion digger trying to remove dandelion plants, particularly from the grass. And they cut dandelion plants at the soil surface and labeled them, and they cut them at 1 inch below the soil and 2 inches below the soil and 3 inches below the soil, tagged them all, did multiple replicates, let them go a full season, came back the next year, and the entire summary of their research was capsulized in one sentence: we didn't go deeply enough. So that taproot that you're talking about just forms a new crown, gets a new plant started. And so you have to dig it, at least we know from the research, you have to dig at least 3 inches deep or more in order to get that root out of there, or the plant will just come back from the same root.
I suppose it's like morning glory. If you just keep digging it, eventually it's going to run out of energy, but I'm afraid that we'll run out of energy a lot quicker than that plant will.
That's true. I have a dandelion plant that has decided to grow in one of my little ornamental shrubs. And I'm into the third year now of cutting this one off because I haven't dared spray it with anything because it's right in the middle of the shrub.
And they seem to, it's like it's this uncanny knack for planting themselves right in the middle of my iris.
Yep.
And I just, and until that point that I transplant the iris or divide it, I can never get to it. Yeah,
I'm sure this was a seed blown in, just like probably for you a seed blown in from some other place. I am pleased to report that the dandelion plant is doing well this year. It has greened up, and it's, even though my shrubs have not yet started to really green up, the dandelion's looking really good. So I think, like you say, I think it wears us out, wears us down before we wear them out.
But you're listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest today is Dr. Ralph Whitesides. He is a professor in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate, and also USU's Extension Weed Specialist. If you'd like to join us with your questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us your question at #ZestyGarden. We are going to go to a quick break. We'll be back in about a minute, and we'll take your questions or comments, and Ralph will be with us for another 15 minutes, so stay tuned.
Put away the saw and enjoy the beauty of your mature evergreen. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Removing the lower branches, called limbing up or crown raising, is done for our convenience, not the health of the tree. Municipalities and homeowners often remove the lower limbs for pedestrian and vehicular clearance or to let the sun shine in for grass to grow. Mature trees, especially evergreens, benefit when healthy lower branches are left intact. Removing large limbs can increase the risk of decay, and overpruning removes many of the energy-producing needles and leaves. This can greatly stress and negatively impact the health and vigor of the tree. Consider extending the mulch bed around the tree to make maintenance easier, and use shade-tolerant perennial ground covers for a bit of added greenery. If you must remove lower branches, do it over a longer period of time to reduce the stress on the plants. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Station volunteers play an important role helping things run smoothly during Utah Public Radio's fundraising drives. We'll appreciate your help as a volunteer starting on April 18th. Shifts are flexible, work one or several hours. Get the behind-the-scenes perspective of your public radio station and meet other public radio listeners. Go to upr.org and click on Come Volunteer for UPR. That's upr.org.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. We want to take your questions or comments, so we hope we hear from you. 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. All right. I wanted to quickly go over a new book that has come out in print this year, and it's called Common Weeds of the Yard and Garden, a Guidebook. And, Ralph, you say this has the 50 top weeds for the Great Basin?
Brenda Lowry did this book as part of the requirements for a master's degree, and in the process of doing that, we surveyed all of the county agents and all of the weed supervisors in the state, and we asked them what were the most common weeds that they thought we would find in the yard and garden. So we excluded the rangeland and the commercial alfalfa fields and corn and wheat and barley, all the agronomic crops. And we created this booklet with 50 of the most common weeds that we think and others thought you would find in your garden in anywhere in the Great Basin. So it applies to Utah, but it also applies to parts of Nevada and Idaho and Wyoming and Colorado. So it's very, very appropriate. It's available in print form from the county offices. It's also available online, free to look at. All you have to do is Google common weeds of the yard and garden, and you'll get it. It has pictures. It has a little biological information about each plant. The hard copy contains some text, and the online copy contains more text because we were limited in space when we actually did the print. So it's been very popular. Its target audience is primarily the horticulturalist, the homeowner, the yard and garden person.
So it talks about location, occurrence, description. Does it describe how to take care of it?
We have, in the expanded version that's available online, there's a section on control In the control section, we concentrated primarily on things like mechanical, physical pulling, the digging. We said a little bit in some cases about prevention, where this is a problem and why it is a problem. You will notice there's a conspicuous lack of herbicide recommendations in here. The reason we did that, that was a conscious decision on our part. The herbicide labels change. When they change, then a recommendation that we would have in a book might be for a product that's no longer available or for which the registration has changed. And so as a result of that, our book becomes obsolete. So we avoided that, and we assumed that you would have to get your information on herbicides from some other source.
Well, and this is great because it's a pocket book size, and it has a glossy page, so you can actually take it out into the garden. If you splatter something on it, it's going to be easy to clean it off. And I just got the name of four different weeds for my garden that have showed up in the last 5 or 6 years that I've never had any idea what they were called. So Persian speedwell has showed up. Prostate knotweed, which is one I don't normally see in the garden, but I do see in the driveway coming up through the cracks. Then creeping wood sorrel has showed up along the periphery. And then the one that's just driving me nuts is henbit. And it looks like they're not large plants, but they have lots of flowers and they like to seed.
And they're really pretty. And
yeah.
So probably one of the reasons why you just learn to appreciate how nice they are. But that's a good example. We put a spiral binding on this little booklet as well, so that when you're in the garden, you could lay the book down and while you're looking at something and hand weeding it. And our goal is to change people's lives, one person at the time if necessary. But we would love it if people knew the name of what it was they were pulling out of the ground, so that as they did their hand weeding, they at least called it by the appropriate right name.
Well, think of how much easier it would be. You don't even have to go to your extension office. You can identify it through the book and then call in and say, what's the best way to control this? Or go online and you know what to look for.
Or if you go to a yard and garden store and you're looking at a product in your turf and you realize that, boy, I know what this weed is now. A good example is the prostrate knotweed that you were talking about. Prostrate knotweed is very adapted to being mowed over. It doesn't ever grow very erect. It's mostly pretty horizontal, and it will tolerate all kinds of foot traffic, and that's why it ends up in driveways and
disturbed area of some kind.
And it does really well in compacted soil.
That would explain, because right next to the driveway where my daughter has driven on the lawn, that's where it's coming up. So.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, that if you can't hit the driveway all the time, this is one of the weeds that's going to appear. And interestingly enough, this one is not readily controlled by a lot of the turf products, the chemical products that are used for turf, because it has an amazing amount of resistance to the standard 2,4-D treatments. And so when it first appeared, we discovered early on that it's not easily controlled by 2,4-D, but it is controlled by one of the components that we see in the multi-mixes, and that's dicamba. So that's why the turf people mix two or three products together.
Well, let's move into talking about herbicide control for weeds as well. And you have some concerns about a couple of products, one in particular that are still good to use if you want to use them, but read the label.
Right.
And so let's talk about this.
Never before have we seen so many cases where people ask us to go look at something. We can't make too many visits, but our county agents make a lot of visits. And as they make visits, what we're seeing is we're seeing the fact that for most people, the herbicide that is known as Roundup, the active ingredient is glyphosate, has become a household word. And the concept is, I will go to the store, I will buy Roundup, and then I will spray my weeds, and the weeds will die, and all of the desirable plants will survive. So one of the key issues is that we are, especially now that Roundup is available in a ready-to-use formulation, all you have to do is buy the product off the bench or the rack and simply squirt it. We see a lot of people who are spot spraying the weeds in their lawn with Roundup. When they do that, Roundup is a non-selective herbicide, which means it kills virtually everything it touches.
So what we get is, and you all out there who are listening will know who's done this because their yard will have round yellow spots in it.
I'm thinking of the checkerboard my grandfather created when I was younger.
Yep. Same effect. And so quite often we spray a dandelion and we kill all the grass around it. Now, the reason that this becomes important is that there are selective products, the turf management products, that will kill the broadleaves and leave the grasses. But recently there have been some products that have entered the market, and they have names like Roundup Extended or Roundup Extended and some others called, I can't remember one of the names of the others now right now. But anyway, what they did was they put the glyphosate together with a persistent herbicide. So if you spray the dandelion in your lawn, you kill the grass, you kill the dandelion eventually, but the persistent herbicide that they put with it will not allow anything else to grow there for 3 to 4 months.
So it just stays in the soil?
It stays in the soil, and it's designed to spray in the gravel driveway, and it's designed to spray perhaps in the crack in the cement on the sidewalk so that you don't get recurrence of the same weed. But in the process of doing that, if people have not, we have always said read the label and use the product according to the label. If you don't read the label on this particular one, your dead spots in your lawn will last the entire summer and won't fill back in until the next year.
Now, if you're trying to kill grass, there are some grass-specific killers that won't kill your ornamentals necessarily.
Right. There are several really great products that are selective and kill grass. They have a variety of trade names, but the products that have a common name called Fluazifop and Cethoxidim are really effective.
Good grief.
Yeah,
say that again real
that's
fast.
It's unfortunate that they have those names, but without promoting a single product, what you'd look for is a grass killer that is safe to use on ornamentals. And so just like 2,4-D kills dandelions but doesn't kill grass, these new products kill grass but don't kill the broadleaves. So if you wanted to kill all the grass in your yard and protect all the dandelions, you could spray one of these and then you'd have a yard full of dandelions. The practical application of this for us, however, is that in the landscape, especially in the flower beds, you can spray over the top of your ornamental flowers, you can spray over the top of your ornamental broadleaf plants, and you can kill the grasses that have encroached in there. So quackgrass is one of our worst, and clearly Kentucky bluegrass. The turf grass that we all plant is also pretty aggressive at moving into the flower beds. And so in the process of doing that, you can spray over the top with these grass killers and end up with pretty much a grass-free flower bed.
If you're looking for something in the garden that will take care of both, I've got this sticky, it's like a thistle. I've never let it grow large enough to find out what it actually is, but it has a long white root that's fairly, I don't want to say brittle, but it'll come off easily enough, but it keeps moving into the garden, and I keep trying to move it back. But I don't grow anything in that area. Is Roundup the type of product that I would look at using, and would I wait until later in the year when it's really pulling it down into the soil? Or
yeah, and in most cases, most gardeners, at least in the vegetable garden, probably should not use herbicides because most of the time it's too hard to manage the rotation, and next year when you plant another vegetable here and then you discover that it didn't grow, it's because it had to do with the herbicide. So we rarely recommend a herbicide in the vegetable garden. But in that perimeter, like you're talking about, between maybe the yard or the road and the garden where you don't intend to grow anything, then the straight Roundup product, not the Roundup Extended, makes a lot of sense and is very effective at keeping the product down. The weed down. You just have to use the product more often, maybe once every month, in order to keep most of the weeds down. And later in the year is indeed better.
Now, is there a product that can be used that's not quite so toxic? I know that at least to keep the seeds from germinating in the first place. There's some gluten, corn gluten, things like that. I think we talked last week with Mark Anderson, and he said he's had mixed success with that.
I think that would characterize our success with that as well.
Okay.
The corn gluten has some activity, but it's not always, it's not as dependable every single time as some of the other commercial products that are not, don't fall under the organic category. So, and some of the organic products that we've tested, although they're pretty active, they are not non-toxic. And so the some of the oils that you can buy, like lemon oil and some of these others, which are certified by the Organic Research Materials Institute as approved for organic weed control, are quite toxic to humans, and so they require very careful care and following the label.
Okay. Well, Ralph, you're going to need to leave. You've got something you need to get to, so thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here, Brian.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and right now we have a new feature that we're beginning, and it's a literary feature about gardening, and this one comes from Nancy Williams of Providence.
April in Cache Valley means showers. You know, the kind that bring May flowers, and those would be the bloomers, not the sailing ships. The very word April conjures hope when we're in the middle of our long slog of winter snow that lasts forever. April sounds like a dance, an old-fashioned cotillion or a quadrille. The feeling of April is sunny, greening, breezy with a chance of sprinkles, covered all over with pussy willow catkins and bright yellow goldfinches. For some reason, April never sounds like it's full of snow, but here in northern Utah, it always is. April is Utah's wettest month, according to the TV weather people. Two of my children were born here in April, and on both of their birthdays, the heavens opened up and covered my daffodils with a 4-inch thick snow blanket. Of course we need the moisture. My garden, in which garlic and spinach are already thriving, and where the carrots that overwintered still have lush green foliage and have been sweetened by living underground all winter, is clearly grateful for this wet and cool spring. I've lived in Cache Valley nearly 50 years. I'm a transplant from northern New Mexico, another high desert landscape where there never was enough rain. I don't know what it's like to live somewhere where there's humidity and grass grows madly without help from sprinklers. Water-wise landscaping is in my blood. But so are beautiful flowers, and I'm crazy about the color green. I'll be sharing my favorite garden lore with you on The Zesty Garden in the weeks to come on happy topics like water, honeybees and butterflies, composting organic fertilizers, birds, community gardens, snoozing in hammocks in the shade in the summer, as well as the more troublesome things that we have to wrestle with, such as gardeners in the desert do, like deer and other varmints, pests like aphids and slugs, and of course, spring snow. I'll be sharing stories from some favorite gardening books, too. One of those is called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate, with the subtitle, At Work in the Wild and Cultivated World. It's by Wendy Johnson. Wendy is the gardener emeritus at Green Gulch Farm Zen Center in Marin County, California, and she's one of the founders of the Organic Farm and Garden Program there. She wrote this wonderful big book, all 445 pages of it, in longhand. It took her 10 years. She's a friend of mine, and I love this book, and I want to share some of Wendy's words on the magic of cold, wet springs. She writes, "When my life goes flat and I forget to heed the real voice of the garden, working with children brings me back to life. I remember coming home from the beach one spring evening when my daughter was small. Night fell earlier than I expected, and I was hurrying Elisa through the spring fields, oblivious to the gathering spell of the March night all around us. Mama, my daughter called out in the descending darkness, let's count the newts walking home on the path. They know where to go even when it's dark. I stopped and looked down. Orange-bellied newts were crossing the muddy path that ran through the shadows of red fescue and purple needlegrass. The Tibetan saint Milarepa's terse advice came to mind, hasten slowly. I stopped rushing and joined the spring night. In complete darkness, 31 newts delivered us home. Following newts home is a kind of a harvest, a gathering in of real wealth and nourishment. So is marking out an abandoned city lot for a vegetable garden, or noticing exactly when the barn swallows return to nest under the March eaves of your tool shed. Real time is told by linked events in the garden, and every garden season has its own particular rhythm and distinct flavor. All the lives this place has had, I have, writes the farmer and poet Wendell Berry. I eat my history day by day. At Green Gulch Farm, after a long winter's diet of savory tofu stew and roasted root vegetables, I crave the first weedy greens of spring. I love to go out with kids of all ages to the woods bordering the muddy spring fields. The sky is low, alive with the scent of rain. We gather wild onions, round-capped miner's lettuce, green necklaces of chickweed, and the tender mallow growing among stands of yellow mustard and pastel radish flowers. Big-leaved maples flower along Redwood Creek in this season, and we harvest 5 or 6 tender flowers from each tree that we can reach. On the homeward trek, hidden garden treasures are uncovered. Tender side shoots of winter broccoli, milk-white cauliflower curds underneath leathery wrapping leaves, handfuls of snow peas, and occasional spears of new asparagus pushing up out of the cold ground like newborn dragons. By the time we get back to the Green Gulch kitchen, it has begun to rain. We heat up oil in the huge wok and make a simple tempura batter. The kids dip maple blossoms into the batter one by one, and broccoli, cauliflower, peas, and asparagus. These spring offerings sizzle and puff up in the hot oil. Lucas and Olivia, the smallest children, help compose this spring weed salad. We are cagey parents. If they make it, they will eat it. A lesson I know well from urban school gardens. Last of all, we steep a lime green wild mint tea and sit down to eat. Black rain pelts the dark windows. Our wet raincoats and muddy boots are drying by the stove as we sit and feast on timeless spring. Happy, wet, cold Cache Valley spring to all of you. This has been Nancy Williams for Utah Public Radio.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
The most popular school program that the Stokes Nature Center offers is a geology lesson for second grade. I'm not sure what happens between second grade and adulthood to make our general perception of geology go from exciting to boring, but you would be amazed at how excited second graders get over rocks, and especially over fossils. Fossils are really quite rare. A very specific set of conditions have to be met in order to create one. Most living things decompose fairly rapidly upon death, leaving no trace of their existence behind. In order to create a fossil, this process of decomposition needs to be halted fairly rapidly, which typically means that the body is quickly covered by some kind of sediment, like sand or soil or mud. For this reason, most fossils are found embedded in sedimentary rock. If pressure and moisture levels are just right, over the course of millions of years, the organism's molecules will slowly be replaced by minerals from the surrounding sediments, eventually turning bone into stone. Only somewhere around 1 in a billion bones will make it through this process. From there, the fossil has to remain intact and identifiable through eons of tectonic plate movement, earthquakes, and mountain uplift. Then, in order to be found, it has to be located near enough to the Earth's surface and in such a place where a human might come across it. Some geologists estimate that only 1 in 10,000 species that have ever lived have made it into the known fossil record, which makes me wonder what discoveries still await us. Fortunately for us, prehistoric Utah was a place where fossilization happened with some regularity, as evidenced by places like Dinosaur National Monument and the Escalante Petrified Forest. Did you know that Utah has a state fossil? That distinction goes to the Allosaurus, a predatory dinosaur that thrived during the late Jurassic period. Numerous skeletons found in east central Utah range in size from 10 to 40 feet in length, meaning this fearsome creature may have rivaled its more famous cousin, Tyrannosaurus rex, for top predator status. With such a rich fossil history, it's not out of the question that you might stumble onto something truly amazing during a routine hike. Can you keep your find? Well, that depends on two things: the type of fossil and whose land it was found on. On public lands in Utah, fossils of vertebrates cannot be collected, while fossils of invertebrates and plants can be. Private landowners have full rights to the fossils found on their property. With all fossils, though, it's a great idea to report your find to the U.S. Geological Survey so that your discovery can be documented for public or scientific research, display, or education. Fossil creation is an incredible phenomenon that has allowed us to glimpse the Earth's history in ways that would otherwise be completely hidden. Thanks to fossils, we can envision a prehistoric landscape filled with giant ferns, enormous dragonflies, long-necked allosauruses, and flying pterodactyls. Without the evidence in the fossil record, I doubt that even the most imaginative person among us could have envisioned such an amazing array of life. For the Stokes Nature Center and Wild About Utah, this is Andrea Liberator.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our listeners and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, where students and faculty promote the sustainability of ecosystems and the communities that depend on them. Information at cnr.usu.edu.
Well, the last item for the Zesty Garden today is our gardening calendar. And there's a landscape design class. It's a weekly event every Wednesday from 9 a.m. to noon. It's at Utah State University's Botanical Center in Kaysville. You'll learn the basics of landscape design, such as how to draw, design, and choose the right plants. A private consultation with course instructors to review your plan will be given on the last day of the course. All materials needed, including handbook, graph paper, and design tools, will be included. Information is at utahbotanicalcenter.org. And then there's a Know Your Soil workshop, Saturday, April 20th, so this Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, at the Salt Lake City Main Library, and it's done through Wasatch Community Gardens. So join Wasatch Community Gardens for a lesson on soil matters. We'll talk about adding organic matter and other amendments, composting, soil testing, identifying nutrient deficiencies, organic fertilizers, and more. Learn how to build your soil from the ground up. To register, go to wasatchgardens.org. They're also having their annual plant sale. It's Saturday, May 11th from 8 a.m. to 1 in the Roland Hall School parking lot on Guardsman Way in Salt Lake. It offers 30,000 plants, so information is at wasatchgardens.org. And then there's a backyard chickens class April 20th, so this Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon at the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main in Cedar City. Information is at 586-8132. Thanks for joining me today on The Zesty Garden.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.